It's about 27 and a half after. That's pretty precise, actually. 27 and a half after the hour on a Transcendent Tuesday here along the Broken Road. Dr. Don Clark joins us from Garden Valley, Texas. Dave is with us, too, from East Dakota. Garden Valley, just about 80, 90 miles due east of Dallas, Texas. That's where he has his vineyard and winery. And he does works with test tubes and everything. Have you ever gotten a proper lab coat done?
I haven't. No. I had one for many, many years.
Well, and yeah.
I don't know what happened to it. Somewhere along the line in our many moves, I guess it didn't get packed.
Well, lab coats. I imagine lab coats need regular laundering, don't they? Because
I think I remember seeing it in one of the boxes at Mar-a-Lago.
Oh, that's what happened to it.
I think I remember seeing one of the FBI. During the raid, I think they must have scooped up the coat. Yeah, I think that's where it is.
That could be. That could it's a goner now.
They're probably running, all kinds of chemical tests on it.
They're doing tests.
To see what was spilled.
That would put it in the National Archives someplace, I think. So
that Trump will now be accused of practicing chemistry without a license.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You can kiss that lab coat goodbye, I think, here. Don Clark Don Clark, a biochemist and a lot of pharmaceutical experience in particular. He's also a member of the board at Creation Moments, and he's a delight to talk with. Don's been with us now for, 10, 11 years, something like that. And we enjoy his good company and his expertise just about every Tuesday morning. Don, we've got really a couple different topics going for us, rocks and cows. Where would you like to start?
Let's start with the rocks, and then we'll maybe end up with the cows.
Already.
And see where we go from there.
Well, this is an article from the Institute for Creation Research, and it talks about the Shrine of Deep Time in a place called Sikar Point. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. What I can't pronounce correctly is Musaceous Schistus, which is a kind of rock they found. They're spotted back there by a geologist, Dr. James Hutton. And this really has to do with the history of the theory of evolution. It goes back I've lost his name in my head now. Darwin. Before Darwin. Thank you for that. Bailed me right out there.
And Charles Lyell as well.
1788, actually 18th century. It was a big day. Three prominent Scottish academics were in the boat. Hutton, and then a geologist, Sir James Hall, and a geologist and mathematician. I don't know what he was doing there, but his name was John Playfair. They thought they were staring into the abyss of time. Sounds very dramatic. Can you explain that occasion in history, John? Don?
Well, yes. So what they spotted at Sikar Point in Scotland, off the coast of east coast of Scotland, was one layer of rock on top of another layer of rock. So the bottom layer was this grayish layer of rock, which is pretty much shale in consistency, and it's called Gray Wacky, Sullivan, Silurian Gray Wacky. And on top of that was this layer of Dovinian upper old red sandstone. So you had shale on the bottom and sandstone on top.
Two contrasting layers then, and the geologist light up at that. But he had a preconceived notion about time and history, and he was looking for evidence, which is kind of I suppose that's how it's supposed to work in science, huh? First you develop a theory, you put out an idea, and then you have to find evidence for it. And he saw this as proof of the old Earth he was looking for.
Well, he did, because he didn't accept, I don't know if he was a Christian or not, but most of the scholars and learned people at that time believed that in the biblical 6,000-year-old age of the Earth, And Hutton was convinced that the Earth was much older than that. And so he was looking for evidence for an old Earth, and riding in his boat, taking a little boat ride, he says, aha, there's the evidence. And so he had the oarmen, I guess, oar them over to this rock formation, and voila, he had struck gold, if you will, but he struck rock. And so he saw this as evidence for deep time, because he hypothesized that, hey, in order to have two layers of rock like that, especially ones that were eroded quite a bit like they were, you had to have a lot of time to do that. Because he actually kind of started this thinking, or this philosophy of uniformitarianism. And it's a big word, and all it means is the rate that I'm seeing today is what happened in the past, and things weren't different back then. So Hutton didn't believe in the catastrophe of a global flood. That was his first error. So he's not believing the Bible, not believing that Genesis is indeed actually a record of history, an accurate record of history, and Earth history as well as man history. And so he decides to come up with his own theories on this. And so he came up with uniformitarianism that says, well, you know, we know today that these rocks age very, very slowly, that is to wear very, very slowly. So that must mean that both of these layers, then, to have one layer on top of the other, that the first layer was laid down and then it eroded over a great period of time. And then the second layer was laid down. Don't explain how the second layer was laid
down. Well, actually, the
first layer.
The theory appears that it comes up from inside the Earth. Was the thinking at the time, that the Earth generated new land every billion years or so, something like that, some long period of time. So the bottom layer would have emerged after the first layer had largely eroded, and then a new layer came up and lifted it up. Apparently, that's the way they saw things then.
Well, yes, that was the beginning of this thinking of deep time, and so... Yes, the first layer would have, you know, rose up from, I guess, the deep of the ocean, and then it eroded, and then another layer over a great period of time would have come up on top of it. Now, you know, what we see as rock today was at one time mud or sand, in the case of sandstone, and over a period of time solidified. Dried out and solidified. So these types of observations, then, is, you know, you can certainly hypothesize that you can guess about anything and hypothesize that, but he really had no evidence to show him how these layers were actually formed. He just kind of pulled it out of the hat, if you will. Well, others following him, Charles Lyell, for example, he, you know, picked up on this concept of deep time, and he was also a geologist, and he wrote a book in 1830, so we're predating Darwin, but not by much now, called The Principles of Geology, where his main thesis is this uniformitarianism from Hutton's theory and guess that, you know, the rock formations and everything happen over a period of time. Charles Lyell picks that up, writes a book. The young Charles Darwin reads the book and readily accepts the uniformitarianism paradigm, and hence leads him, when he goes to the Galapagos and sees the finches of various types of finches in various parts of the Galapagos, he says, aha, you see, we got evidence. got evidence of evolution staring me in the face. I've got to draw all these birds and write them down, and I'm going to, you know, come up with another book. And so, hence the birth of Charles Darwin's book about evolution.
Origin of the Species, you know. I guess it was called.
What's that?
Origin of the Species, I think, was the title of Darwin's
Origin
book.
Of the Species, yeah, is the mm-hmm. primary title. But the secondary title has to do with selection of chosen races. Let me see if somebody, maybe our guest there in the background, could search the subtitle of Darwin's book. And that gives us information about what these people were thinking at the time. Because, when you have a favored race, that means you have unfavored races. And so, therefore, the favored race is going to take over and dominate the unfavored races. So Charles Darwin, those who lift him up as the father of evolution and say, you see, the Bible is incorrect, and, he has proven without a shadow of a doubt that evolution does exist. And so we have obviously spoken about evolution time and time again on this program and about its failings in describing the things that we see around us. And so we have we have kind of this dichotomy, but the origin is that, it pushes gods out, and it's very racist. So Charles Darwin, even in the subtitle of his book, gives us a hint.
Yeah, I'm looking at that complete title now. It says, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Interesting.
Yes, and the second half of that is never, discussed or printed. It's only the origin of species. And the reason is because it is so racist. And we don't want to talk about that because, that's going to get folks into trouble. So we suppress that information and we just talk about, yes, we evolved, and man is continuing to evolve. And one of these days, we'll be able to put our consciousness in computers, and guess what? We can live forever. I mean, that's where all of that is going. But it's only going to be the favored race that is going to achieve that. And if you look back in not that far of history, we had a fellow called Hitler in Germany. And he was trying to, based on these principles, was trying to develop a superhuman race, his Aryan race. And so every other race was inferior to the Aryan race. And, of course, that led to the Holocaust and him trying to annihilate the Jews. But he was also trying to annihilate the blacks. And so there again, we've got this strong racism going on with these types of folks. It's only the Bible that we get the notion that all men are created equal. And then when you take that out and when you say that, well, the Bible isn't quite correct because we've proven that this 6,000 years isn't quite right, and it's we really have eons and eons of time, and we really evolved. God didn't speak us into existence and formed us from the dust of the earth. And by the way, man isn't special. Like the Bible says that we were created in his image, we're just a favored race over other animals, in particular chimpanzees and monkeys.
You know what all this does is it removes the whole idea of evolution from science and puts it squarely under the heading of ideology or even faith system, because science had little to mm-hmm. real science had little to do with it.
Right. At that, yes, little science had little to do with it. And subsequent to all of this, we have this explosion at Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens blew its top in the early 80s. And we see that from that cataclysmic explosion and the frozen lake that was on the top of the mountain rushing down, we get layers upon layers of dirt, mud essentially being laid down based on the density of the dirt, the earth particles in the mud. And we see canyons formed, you know, in less than a day, and, you know, 160-foot canyons being formed, layers being laid down, dirt being, you know, the mud being upturned at various places, the same type of thing that we see in the Grand Canyon and other places, in this particular case, at that Sikkar point that, you know, we started this whole discussion of. So catastrophe theory and the global flood would explain that which was being seen at Sikkar Point on that fateful day back in the 1788. I think that was the date.
That's the year.
Yeah, 1788. Hutton's book is called The Theory of the Earth, but I don't know that it was ever a theory, you know, in the scientific movement or the scientific method. I mean, you go from a hypothesis
in the scientific sense. It had little to do with science,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, but I don't know. I mean, it's as a theory, it has to be replicated in order to be accepted.
Is it possible that it wasn't a theory, but it was a reaction, and an opposite reaction to what Genesis had to say? In other words, these people who are claiming to bring us the truth and to correct our notion of what Genesis says, they had to come up with another idea. Because the Bible couldn't be true, and it certainly wasn't science. Well, we make no claims that Genesis was science. It is history. So maybe that was the impetus for this whole thing, was to actively refute the Genesis version of creation. Don, what do you think?
Well, that certainly could have been a big part of it, and we don't know, you know, if James, like I said, whether he was a religious man or not, it doesn't seem to be, but maybe there's some history about him that would, you know, tell us whether or not he was. We know that Charles Darwin, for example, kind of rebelled against his religious family there for a while. There's some evidence that maybe he finally accepted Christ before he died and repented of what he had written. But that's kind of hidden in more speculation than I think really in fact.
Here's a quote from Hutton's book in this article, and he says, "No, David was right. Theory of the Earth was the title of his book." He says, "The result, therefore, of our present inquiry is that we find no vestige of a beginning, no prospect of an end."
Hmm.
I mean, that's pretty certain conclusions based upon zero evidence.
Yep, and based on just observing these two rock layers, I mean, that is a stretch, you know, to throw out the catastrophe of the global flood. And like I said, he didn't believe in a global flood. And so to completely throw that out. And to basically, you know, the title of the book is Theory of the Earth. But, you know, in the real scientific method sense, as you were beginning to discuss, you start with a hypothesis and usually the null hypothesis. This is what I want to disprove. And then you do an experiment. And voila, you've proved your null hypothesis, or maybe, you know, you counterproved it. But eventually, after doing many, many experiments, not only in your own lab, but other people picking it up, your hypothesis then becomes a theory. And so, but, you know, for these folks to just title their books The Theory of, is a bit ostentatious.
Well, presumptuous. And, well, I think you nailed it when you mentioned the null point. The null point for the hypothesis would have been Genesis. And so they had to come up with something to refute that, to explain what happened apart and in opposition to what Genesis says happened. Hence, they adopt the grandiose title of theory when it's really a wild guess.
This was the start of the Earth, and oh, by the way, there is no beginning. Interesting, the first verse in the Bible says in the beginning. His whole theory or guess is that there was no beginning and there's no end. It's just we got these endless cycles of Earth rising up and then being eroded and then rising up again, when indeed the very rock formation that he was looking at is evidence of a global flood. In a catastrophe that, you know, happened sometime in our past. And that, how long was that, past? It was only 4,500 years ago and not eons and eons of time. So, from that time of Hutton to Charles Lyell to, of course, Charles Darwin. But Charles Lyell laid it all down in the Principles of Geology, because he firmly held on to this uniformitarianism approach, in that what you see today is what has happened in the past and what is happening in the future.
You know, I've got another thought to contribute here, because I think that Lyell was an amateur geologist. He was a lawyer, was his vocation. So if you think about the kind of logic explanation, the whole dynamic of explaining something is the bailiwick of the law. And so he constructed this idea that captured Charles Darwin, that he took off with the idea and applied it to animals and races of humans as well. So I think there's something to the idea that somehow a lawyer got involved with this.
Well,
and warped the Sutton, drained the science
Sutton
from it.
Was an apprentice to a lawyer early in his life.
Uh-huh.
When he was 17.
Okay.
Then he went back to the University of Leiden, was bored with the law, and got into medicine. Yeah, he was chasing a degree in medicine.
Well, interesting history of all these people that gave birth to the theory, and I put that in quotes, air quotes. You can see me doing the theory of evolution. Don,
in the middle of the Wikipedia article, it says Hutton also put forward a thesis for a system of the habitable Earth proposed as a deistic mechanism designed to keep the world eternally suitable for humans.
Deistic mechanism.
Deistic mechanism. And I'm not sure if that's Wikipedia putting that in or that came from Hutton, but it suggests that it doesn't. We don't really need a supreme being to make this work.
Okay.
We have a mechanism in place.
It's kind of a deist alternative then, I guess.
Right.
Okay. Yep. Don, another topic you brought to our attention today comes from Mercola.com. Has to do with cows, and we've talked about the environment quite often on our conversations with you. This is something the Irish government has just proposed, to reduce Irish cow herds by 10% over the next 3 years to meet the European Union, the EU's climate change targets, which includes a 25% reduction in emissions from farming by 2030. Now, reducing, that means, well, we kill cows and eat them. Do we have to eat more beef? Is that the outcome of this? Is that how that works?
You have to kill the cows.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically saying, let's kill the cows. And they're not offering a choice. They're saying you have to reduce your herd by 10%. And if there's no market for that herd, then I guess you just destroy the animals. And It's interesting, and this article just popped up today in Mercola, that we're talking about the Irish government, and we know that Ireland is next to Scotland.
Yeah.
So, that was just by coincidence. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's this whole, you know, we can't have too much CO2 in the air, and so we got to get rid of the cows because they produce too much CO2. And, oh my goodness, that's going to destroy the environment. Well, the interesting thing about all of this is that if you eliminate the animals, then you change the microclimate on which the animals used to roam. And there's a reason for the animals. There's a reason for the grazing animals, because there's a cycle of, eating the grass and then fertilizing the grass at some time later. And that whole cycle keeps the environment in a state that is healthy. It's healthy for the land. It's healthy for the people around it. And if you stop grazing on a piece of land, then what we have, evidence from other areas, what happens to the land is that it can become a desert. Not only do you not have the natural fertilization of the soil, and then the soil can't support plant life anymore, and then lack of plant life, of course, leads you to bare ground, which ultimately changes the environment drastically, and so you move towards a more desert environment instead of having a nice blooming field, full of grass and full of nutrients that can support life. So the thrust of all of this, nonsense, insanity, is that you take a beautiful grassland and turn it into a desert land, which will affect the people. Not only do they not have the beef anymore, but, Bill Gates is going to take care of that because he's developing synthetic beef for us. And so that can, we'll have beef from the lab, and he's going to supply the world with the synthetic beef. So we don't need these animals after all, but we will find that the land is not only not supporting the animals, but it's also not supporting humans.
You know, what's interesting is that this cyclical injection or increase of CO2 has been going on for a long time. And every time the CO2 level goes up, grasslands proliferate and food supply increases. So I'm thinking, what's the downside to CO2? And they're saying temperature increase. That's turning out not to be, there's no evidence of that. Of warming,
yes,
global warming.
Very global, and there was a gal, I don't know who she was, but I was just, my wife had a program on a political program on, and this gal is screaming about global warming and the climate, and saying how people are ridiculous that they don't believe in this, and they're crazy, and I mean, she's screaming. And then the fact is that these people are nuts, globalists, and these people that that use the climate as an excuse to impose their will upon other people, when in fact we've been man has been herders for a long, long period of time. And, of course, we learn from, again, the Bible, for example, that early Israel, Abraham and his family and his uncle, and his, in Lot, for example, they were raised sheep and goats.
They were herdsmen, yes.
They were herders, and they roamed about, and they would be in an area for a while, and then they'd go to another area, and the area that they left was more fertile than when they got there.
You know, there's a link between these two stories, and the pattern is similar between the two. It's when ideology trumps science, and you get carried away with the ideology, and science gets left in the dust. And when you speak up in opposition, claiming to have science that refutes the ideology, you get silenced and snuffed out. Now, I should say that it's interesting this story comes from Ireland, where, of course, there is County Cork. And my proposed solution to this whole CO2 problem from cows is corks. You know?
Well, there you go.
Yeah,
so he's going somewhere with this. I don't know.
Science is clear.
Yeah, I don't know. I think we've come to the end of this program.
I think we have.
Could be a county bag.
Well, it's as reasonable as what they're pushing here. So, why not? Don Clark, I mentioned member of the board at Creation Moments. They have a wonderful website, creationmoments.com, and there you will find libraries of information, videos, articles, books that explain and establish for you the biblical story of creation, so you can defend it, you can understand it, and then pass on that information to people who question it. Discussions around the water cooler, for example. You might pay him a visit, creationmoments.com, and you'll be delighted with what you see there. Don, delighted with what we heard from you today. We'll look forward to next week. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, I'm glad we're up and running again.
Yeah, I got
all the computer problems have been solved.
The ship is going 100% full speed ahead again. That's a good feeling. So we'll see you. Have a great week.
Good.
Good to see you, Don.